Let me start. Can everybody hear me in the back also? Thank you. So I'll start with a question for you. I called this big data and social media the future of mobile. So I'm curious to know of the people who came and after a long day at work for most of you, how many of you came because you were interested by the title big data? Okay, so maybe a third. How about because of social media? Also about a third. What about the fact that it was combined with mobile in there? Okay, so everybody. All right. Very good. So just wanted to point out, this is one of the reasons why, if we are to look at what's going on for many of the companies that you're working with and that we see in the news every day, there have been some really disruptive changes. Certainly, cloud computing has been one of them, and I'll mention that a bit. Social has actually turned out to be a huge one. We'll talk about how mobile, big data, and then perhaps algorithms might be the next disruption. But these are all the things that we're going to cover and explain why I'm going to have something to say to each of your interests, because it's the combination or the convergence of all of those things that is making such a big difference in our lives today and in business. Okay, so let's look at this picture. Moore's Law is driving mobility. We see on the left side the smartphone of 2009. 60 megahertz processor. We mentioned the iPhone as being something that was extremely important. When it came out in 2009, as we see the picture there, the slim version at $599. If you were to look at the information on the left-hand side, is it very similar to what you see on the right-hand side? That was the PC, 2001, the Mac. So in less than 10 years, you reduced the price and you reduced the size enormously. So imagine the miniaturization that said that almost everything on the right-hand side in the Mac could be put into the small package that was the iPhone. So how many of you have heard of Moore's Law? Okay, everybody. So somebody tell me, how would you characterize Moore's Law? What would be a definition of Moore's Law? Is anyone willing to venture a guess or know it a little bit more in detail?
Depends on how much circuit you can cram on a chip.
In a chip.
That you double the amount you can put on the chip every frequency.
Exactly. So this is exactly what we have. We have a situation where we had Gordon Moore, one of the founders of Intel, who noticed, and I think it was in 1965, he noticed that since the start of the chip, from 1958 to 1965, he had realized that the number of components on the chip had doubled every year, from 1958 to 1965. And so he said in 1965, I bet we can continue that for another 10 years. Well, it looks like Intel managed to continue that trend for a lot longer than 10 more years. Now, they then changed Moore's Law to say something like doubling every 2 years, so that it made it a little bit easier. But recently, in the past year, they've gone back to a single year doubling. And the way they've done that, if you see the picture, is by actually changing the size. So now you have something like 94 million transistors in less than the size of a nail. And you're doing that by essentially changing the line width and the size on the chip. So Intel has continued with that, and that has actually driven what? Mobile and smartphones, so that if you can put all of that power into a phone, like the iPhone, all of a sudden you've got mobile data traffic exploding. So what's interesting about this graph that was provided by Cisco? I think a couple of things sort of strike you. 92% compound annual growth rate from 2010 to 2015 is what's considered, of which video is going to be a very, very large percentage of that traffic. But there are quite a few other things. And if you look at the diagram, what's interesting is each of these colors kind of are in the stack. And so it's really quite interesting to look at mobile video, mobile web data, mobile peer-to-peer, mobile machine-to-machine increasing, mobile gaming being a large part, and mobile voice over IP. So a number of different things are driving the growth of mobile data traffic. Okay, now I've written a book and teach a class here at Hong Kong University on Web 2.0. And when I talk about Web 2.0 and Web 2.0 strategy, I often say that it started out in 2005. And we can actually come up with a date for Web 2.0 starting as being 2005. Because up until that time, there was more data being downloaded from the web than being uploaded. Okay, so between 1995 and 2005, of 10 years, you actually had more data that was being downloaded rather than being uploaded. So in 2005, there was a crossover point. And that's why Time magazine, on the left-hand side, a very well-recognized magazine, said that the person of the year was the person in the center of that computer screen. Doesn't that look completely dated? That you have this huge screen on a desk, and it says you in the middle? And it says you because it was talking about user generated content, that many people were putting their photos, their digital goods on the web and sharing them, so that it was creating this kind of digital stone soup where everybody could take pieces of it away, share it, and yet somehow it was never depleted. It became this large kind of archive of many, many different items of digital goods. And then, just 2 years later, 2007, we had Time magazine talking about the best invention. And what do we see there? Of course, the iPhone. And then in 2009, just 2 years later, we have Twitter. So these short messages that are actually creating a lot of traffic and a lot of new information that's real-time appearing on the web. Okay. How many of you use Facebook? Okay, a large number, so much, much larger. How about LinkedIn? Okay, so very, very good. So all of you are familiar with the fact that these social networks have really revolutionized the way we interact together and the way we get information and the way we're influenced by what others do who are in our social circle. In fact, many of you probably are familiar with the term social graph, this idea that somehow on the web and on the mobile, that somehow we have this relationship or an ecosystem of all of the people that we know and work with or are involved with. Facebook also is an important social platform. It's one of the fastest growing viral applications. So if we were to look at this graph here, one of the things that I think is very interesting is that iLike was a music favoriting application that was one of the first to come out on the Facebook platform. So the Facebook platform offered for free applications to be distributed on its social platform. So rather than just viral marketing, now you had viral distribution. You could actually distribute applications to all of your friends through Facebook. And so you can imagine what that means in terms of viral kinds of activities. So if you liked a new application, like a music favoriting application, iLike, it could appear to all of your friends. And those friends could then distribute it to their friends. Now, this was one of the first applications where we realized that the fact that I'll look at my classes sometime and I'll ask, how many friends do you have? And it used to be maybe even a year or two ago, I'd ask that question and people would say, 100. Maybe I asked a year ago and maybe the answer was about 200 or 300 would be the average. Now, when I go on and ask a class, especially if they're under 30, they'll say 700. So if you imagine that something would be distributed, if any of the software that you had or digital goods that you had could be distributed instantaneously to 700 people who then instantaneously distributed it to another 700 people, you can imagine how quickly applications and software and digital goods sort of zoom across the Facebook platform. Another thing that was interesting about Facebook and its platform was that it was offered for free. Okay, so unlike Apple's platforms, where Apple gets 30% of the revenue from developers that put apps in the App Store, Facebook actually allowed all of its applications to be distributed for free. So Zynga, for example, the social gaming company, could put all of its social games on Facebook without paying Facebook for that privilege. So that was a very interesting strategy to start with. Now, of course, there's some question about whether Facebook is going to extract some landlord kind of rental fees for having hosted so many of these popular applications. But at least for now, Facebook is a platform that distributes virally for free. So, how many of you have tried Google Plus? Okay, what do you think? Any thoughts?
A bit better than the previous Google attempt at social media.
Okay.
To say.
A little bit better than before. Somebody else? Positive? What are some differences that you see between that and Facebook? Or why would somebody want to use it rather than Facebook? Somebody who's used both. Yeah? Okay, it actually can take advantage of the fact that you might have an established social circle of very different people, not just friends or not friends, right? So it allows you some distinguishing of the many different circles that you might have that have already been established. Somebody else? Anyone else in terms of why they would use Google Plus rather than Facebook? Okay. Yeah.
Maybe they open their data for search.
Ah, interesting. They open their data for search. So it might be that the fact that Google will allow certain APIs may turn out to be a big advantage, because many, many players in the market are feeling like Facebook is having an unfair monopoly in some ways of being a single sign-in for so many things. So that could be a very interesting advantage in the future, that that Google might open up its API for data. Okay? So, let's see. Groupon, everyone has seen that. Of course, one of the reasons people believe that it's been successful as in mobile, it is mobile e-commerce, but perhaps not as social or as virally distributed as Facebook applications. Okay, the other thing that, of course, you've seen is that consumer apps are in the cloud. And one of the things that Cisco and many other people are talking about is that we are in a situation now where so many of the applications and the advances we're seeing are happening first in the consumer space and then moving to the enterprise. And so, indeed, we have many, many consumer apps in the cloud where computing power, storage, and applications are delivered through a public or private network, and also that it can be consumed as operating expenditure, sort of pay as you go for many startups, rather than having to pay something up front as a capital expenditure. So there's a whole different economics to the fact of the cloud. Okay, so here, after we've seen all of these different trends, what does that mean, and why do we call this big data? So, what's new with big data? I think many of you are familiar with the enterprise databases that are in big companies, where you analyze the data for insights into marketing or whatnot. What's new about the situation now with the kind of data that we have? We've just gone through a couple of important trends. What is difficult for the large relational databases and customer databases that you have in most of your big companies to deal with? What do you think is the challenge that this new situation creates for us? Okay, first of all, it's huge. The amount of data that's being generated is really huge. Petabytes. I think that there's an interesting saying that Eric Schmidt comes up with, that every 2 days we create more data than we have in the past 1,000 years. So it's a pretty amazing thought that we've put so much data in there. So there's lots and lots of data there. But is that what you were thinking about? Okay, so that's interesting. Not only do you have so much data, but how do you get insight out of this data? And quickly, right? Not only is it accumulating quickly, but do you have the resources to analyze it to find what you're looking for? What might be another problem with this data or challenge for this data? Yeah. Other challenges with this data?
Well, because if user created, you don't know if it's true, what's the quality of the data.
Okay, so it could be whether it's true or not. Another one? Yeah? Okay, so it's self-reported. Well, you know, there are two problems with this. Not only the authenticity of the data, but also the fact that if it comes from an individual, maybe it's in text, or maybe it's in voice, or maybe it's in an unstructured content like photos, or possibly video. Okay? So all of this user-generated content that we said were digital goods often come as unstructured data that cannot be analyzed or even stored very easily in the databases that we have. Okay, so a large percentage of the data traffic that we're getting from both mobile and from the web now is in a form that we can't store or analyze easily. Okay? So that's the first difficulty. Other reasons. Well, if we have so much data coming in so quickly, how quickly do we have to analyze it? We might have to analyze it almost in real time. Do our databases do that right now? Not really. Very difficult. So, you know, we have to crunch a lot of data and make sense of it very quickly. And do we store it all while we're analyzing it? Maybe not. So part of what's going on and what you're seeing in this picture here on the left-hand side is all of the new kinds of software and analytics that are being put together for what we call fast data. The stuff that streams in so quickly that it makes things seem as if, you know, the difference between when we used to be able to analyze a solid in physics versus a fluid in fluid mechanics. Okay? So that's the magnitude of the difference. You have some things that are almost like, you know, what you could do with Newtonian physics, which have very different laws than what you would do with something that was a fluid or moved very quickly, where the velocity of the data is very large. So we have fast data, and those are things that are trying to do something with data as it comes in and streams through, rather than picking it up, storing it, creating a haystack, and then going around with a magnet trying to find the pieces of gold or whatever in the haystack. Okay? So here, created into a river of flowing data, and just choose the pieces that you need as they flow by, and let the rest of it essentially continue flowing and not store it. So a whole different concept of how you might actually find information and insight from your data real time. Big analytics is a whole area that has come up where you're looking at all of these different things and coming up with different ways of analyzing them. Not only using things like machine learning, but also all of these different software products that use different statistical methods to try and figure out what's useful in this huge stack. If anything, it's kind of like saying you have this haystack, and instead of looking for the pieces of gold in there with a magnet, these are all ones that are saying, well, at least can we figure out what the shape of the haystack is. Okay? And then the final one on this side is all of the new ways in which we have to try and figure out insight from all of this information. And you see some terms there that I think maybe you haven't seen before in IT. They are unsupervised learning, social media analytics, sentiment analysis, predictive modeling, network analysis, business intelligence, business process. Can't even read. Visualization and simulation. So these are all very important terms and techniques and technologies that are being used to kind of glean some kind of insight from this flow of data that is coming from both social media as well as mobile. And they're they're being used in many, many different ways. So, for example, social media analysis is trying to look at the stream of things that might be coming in on Twitter and figuring out if it means something about what a company needs to do to keep its companies, keep its customers happy. You have sentiment analysis, where you might have lots of voice data being transmitted, actually being converted into text so that it could be cluster analyzed to find out if it indicated positive or negative sentiment towards a brand or towards a product or towards a service. You have network analysis, which is trying to look at the structure of interactions between different parties in the social graph to try and understand if maybe you are more valuable to a company as a customer, not because you spend a lot, but because you influence other people who spend a lot. So that's a whole different idea about what a friend is worth. How many friends you have might be more important than how much you spend yourself, or how you influence those friends might be more important. So visualization, how do you take all of this information and data and try and figure out what it all means? So all of these things are coming together under deep insight. So if we were to look at the picture on the very bottom, what we're saying there is the amount of data that's stored by the average company today happens to be in the terabytes. All of these things are involving petabytes, exabytes, and zettabytes. An amazing amount of data that needs to be looked at. So this is entirely changing what's going on in the enterprise world. So we have a number of things here that are talking about what's going on in big data and how it's dealing with the fact that social media is creating a lot of data that is difficult to analyze and is in a different form than the field and fixed fields that we've had in the past. Okay. Now, the difficulty is that the enterprise has a lot of this data, but it doesn't have a lot of the expertise and capability because a lot of these things are pretty new. It's not in their DNA, and as such, a lot of small companies are the ones that are kind of pioneering the methods that are being used in this whole area. A lot of the question is, how do you get from all this data, fast data, big analytics, and social business intelligence, to actually doing something with it? How do you make any of these insights actionable? How do you collect, if there's thousands of Twitters about your company, how do you immediately figure out that that's something you need to act on and then do something that either changes the sentiment of those individuals or somehow creates some kind of damage control if there's negative sentiment? So part of the issue is information is not knowledge, as Einstein said. Here's two pictures that kind of illustrate the challenge that most large companies, for example, the telecom companies and telcos, are facing today. There's a data deluge. So you have, you know, the picture on the right-hand side with the economist, where you might have an umbrella and you have huge amounts of data that are pouring down, but it's pouring down almost too fast to be able to nurture the small flowers of information that you're looking for. On the left-hand side, I think this is really very much the case. The database of useful information is very small, and the database of useless information is very large in that haystack that we talked about. So, let's at least talk about what some of the things that are being done with big data, some of the companies that are pioneering ways to work with big data. We're going to look at how they solve some big problems, and in some cases can make customers happy while they spend more and influence their social circle when and where they play or work. How does it do that? How can big data help solve big problems? What would be a really big problem? One I think is interesting is 350 million people. China will add one New York City essentially a year from now till 2025. Every year. Well, that's a lot of cities to add. So a huge population. And with every one of those populations and cities, all of the issues that go along with an urban population. So if we imagine that a planet of smarter cities is going to arrive in 2007, the majority of the world's population will live in cities. So 70% of the Earth's total population will be in a city, 6.4 billion. How are we going to manage that? Both from an energy standpoint, from a regulation standpoint, from a housing standpoint, so many different environmental issues. Well, here's where big data and your smartphone can help. Here are some of the things that are actually being done. I think this one was an interesting situation. It turns out that you could approach a problem like garbage on the street in two very different ways. One is on the left-hand side. Using your mobile phone, now there's a way of tracking through your mobile phone these little tags that New York City had put in its garbage bags to track how quickly garbage was being picked up and how quickly it was being moved from the street and its location to the dump. So actually a sort of garbage transportation monitoring system using little tags on the garbage and being monitored by a smartphone. So that's an example of crowd sensing. An alternative method is crowdsourcing. There is an application that's come out where everybody can download an app that says, would you like to report a problem in your city? Whether it be trash, sanitation, graffiti, or a street light that doesn't work. You can become part of the crowdsourcing that helps create a better local environment for everyone. So two very different ways of having everybody help out in making a city better. Augmented reality in New York City. I think this is a really fun application because New York City actually held a contest. It said, if you had an iPhone, how would you use it to augment your reality? In other words, to add information or data layer on the city. And one of the two top prizes that won, the first one was, I'd like to be able to hold up my phone in any location of the city and have it tell me which direction I need to go to the nearest subway station. And also give me some idea if I pointed in another direction, if it would be further going in the other direction, and information on where the station and what and how far, which one it would recommend me to go to get to the location I'm going to. So in other words, a kind of Google Maps or Google navigation that we expect from our cars and GPS, but for pedestrians. And for you to actually use your phone as a video to be able to tell you which way to go just by holding it up and using it. So that was one of the ones that won a prize from New York City. They use their phone video function. How about the Internet of parking spaces? I don't know how difficult it is to park in Hong Kong, but certainly in San Francisco and Los Angeles, it's very difficult. So instead of squeezing into a space, like the picture up here, that's, I guess, what one has to do in many different locations, is actually sort of find a space in between the other spaces, maybe on the side. Actually, there was an attempt by the company that was originally started at Berkeley called Streetline, which was a smart grid mesh system that created a internet of parking spaces. So all of these little mesh networks would tell you each of these would tell you which parking space was open. So here we have a parking space that's not on the street, but if you had a little sensor in each of these parking spaces, it could tell you by phone whether it was open or not, and whether you should go to this area to park or not. So this was the idea behind the parking space, the Parker, that was a free app that became available. It also went about just telling you while you were driving by voice where the closest parking space was and how much it was going to cost you. The reason it had that is because both San Francisco and Los Angeles thought, the municipal governments thought, it was a wonderful idea to have what we call dynamic pricing for parking. So this is where the price of your parking varies depending on the time of day and how crowded or congested the area you're trying to park in is. Okay? So for the city, this makes a lot of sense. If you can look at your phone and say, okay, I'm willing to pay $3 an hour or $10 an hour for parking in this area because it's a very crowded day or it's very rainy and it's difficult to find a parking, then you know in advance and you go into the city. If you aren't willing to pay that, then maybe you're willing to take public transportation or go another day. So it actually manages very well sort of the demand for parking spaces. It also makes a big difference in the actual traffic in the city. One of the studies that they were able to do with Streetline is to discover that at least 30% of the traffic in a city is not actually going to your destination. It's actually wandering around the street trying to find parking. So 30% of the traffic in a city is caused by parking rather than trying to get to your destination. So this is one of the things that they did to try and alleviate that. Okay, how about another cool application of big data, real time to your phone? This is a taxi application where CabSense helps you figure out, based on 90 million pieces of information about traffic in a city like Chicago, where to stand on a rainy day to catch a cab. That's something I could have used today, for sure, in Hong Kong. I ended up taking a bus and a tube because I was not able to find a cab. I didn't have cab sense for Hong Kong. The idea is that what it does is, if you see here, it finds all of these different locations, and then it says, well, this corner is 4 stars. That means that if you stand there, your chances are better than one that has 3 stars. And that 4 stars mean that for that particular corner, it has like 20 cabs per hour come through it, while if it's 3 stars, it's only 10 per hour. And these vary by time and by weather and whatnot, so that you can figure out where the best, predicting where the best place to get a cab might be. I think that's an amusing idea that you could do that with big data. Another thing, of course, is the use of mobile payment. We saw this both with Twitter for the Japanese tsunami, earthquake, as well as raising $150 million for Haiti relief. So we had U.S. relief donations completely sped up. If you look on this side, this is something that recently was put out by the Red Cross. In December of 2004, they were only able to raise $30 in the first 3 days for Asian tsunamis. By 2005, in Hurricane Katrina, they raised about $108 in the first 4 days. By using this text to donate, where you just texted Haiti at 90999, 100% of your $10 donation passed through to the Red Cross, $150 million was raised in the first 4 days. So just the speed of mobile payment is really quite amazing and has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. So if we were to say that the macro level use of aggregate local location data can help to make smarter cities, urban planning, sense networks, what could we do with that for retail business intelligence? Could it help us with shopping patterns, insights for promotions, advertising, granular intelligence and segmentation? We know that it can, and we know this from a very funny source that I'll just mention because I didn't put it up here. We know that from casino gambling. How many of you have been to Macau and tried their slot machines? It turns out that in the past, 5 years, one of the Harvard Business School professors decided to leave Harvard Business School and go to become the chief operating officer and then the CEO of Harrah's, one of the big casinos. And the reason he did that was because he thought that he could probably revolutionize the gambling and casino industry using data. And he discovered that he could do that, because what he did was actually run information and analytics on all of his customers, and you can get a huge amount of data, I guess, in the casino, because now all of your slot machines are wired up and wired, so that as soon as you insert a card or start playing, they know a lot about who's playing and how often you've played, what you've won, what you've lost, which games or which casino games you play. And through this, he was able to discover that everything that the industry had known up to that point and used as experience was actually wrong. So here was a good example of intuition and experience versus analytics. It turned out most of the industry felt that what was going on was that big rollers, people who came in and splashed a lot of money, were the customers that were the most profitable. It turned out that when they actually did the analysis, that was absolutely not the case. That the more frequent sort of small-time gamblers who came often and frequently had a much higher lifetime value than these high rollers. And that Harrah's could actually motivate them and promote their machines on a real-time basis. So I hate to tell you, because maybe you'll never go back, but in the casino, they actually know exactly when you as an individual will reach your frustration or I'm ready to leave this machine point. And you'll be amazed, because if you're losing exactly that amount at exactly the threshold that they know for you as an individual, somebody will come up to you and say, you might not be having a good day, here's a free promotion, have dinner and try back later. So they'll have figured out whatever the promotion is that will keep you there and keep you, maybe you leave that day, but have you come back later. So they've actually gotten it to the point, to an individual level, what they need to have you be a happy and frequent customer in their casinos. So after I heard that, I thought, oh, I'm never going to play a slot machine again. Because they'll gather all this information about me, and then I'll never leave. So, okay, how can you apply that to that concept to shopping on an everyday basis or to your everyday local experience with your phone? How can you make customers happy while spending more, while promoting a brand and influencing their friends? How can we make it a win-win situation both for the customer as well as for the enterprise that wants to collect information and better target and personalize their offer? Well, at least Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, at a recent conference, said, this is the goal of Web 3.0. We can start, if we can use big data analytics, we can start to use massive amounts of personal data. Everything you use, whether it be from surveillance cameras to every tweet or every blog input you put down, or what you say in a voice conversation that is recorded into text. All of this generated by Web 2.0 can deliver highly personal, customized experiences that are relevant to personal interests, to your relationships and your social graphs, as well as to your real-time location. So making it local as well. So this is the concept of the future, in some sense, that everyone's looking at. Have many of you tried Foursquare? Okay. So the idea of Foursquare is a kind of Twitter plus location. So whenever you check in to a location, you might leave a tip, as well as you might actually inform everyone else you know, as in the picture, immediately, kind of as a default condition, where you are and what you've done. So everyone in your social graph kind of knows that you've been to Starbucks, or that you've gone, you're the mayor of a certain restaurant or nightclub, because you've been there that often. Recently, they did a little test of how many Twitter posts were made per hour at the Southwest conference. And in this particular situation, you can see that there are moments where there are about 1,000 Twitters per hour at the conference, and that per day, that runs into the thousands, matching posts per day. So you end up with a huge amount of information about where people are, what they're saying, what their tips are, what they do at each of these different locations. And so the idea is that maybe you could use that, as Twitter does, as Foursquare does, to incentivize you to go to the places you want to go most. So you personalize and you also recommend. But the recommendations that you have might come from people in your social graph, so that you yourself know that 20 of your friends have been to the same Starbucks and have all liked the Frappuccino there. So it personalizes the experience because you know where they've been, what they've done at a different location, and whether you could get a promotion by doing the same thing. So the big data sort of play now is personalizing that information of location and of commerce using kind of very personalized through your own social graph recommendation engines. It also is what we call gamification. Life is a game. What people are discovering with Foursquare, where if you've tried it, there are lots of different ways in which they try to make it a little bit competitive. For example, you could become the mayor or the person who goes to an area the most, but you could be kind of toppled from that position by somebody else who comes along and visits it more often. You get different kinds of points and promotions if you actually end up going to a new place versus somewhere you've been previously. So it's all trying to create a kind of sense of fun or game about what you're doing in real life. In other words, taking some of the things that they're discovering about what incentivizes people in a social or online game and putting it back into local and real life. Micropayments, as you saw with Twitter and text, they're going to be a key area. Social reputation scores and location-based local commerce. So, of course, the big challenge is going to be the consumer surplus, being able to actually sort of monetize some of these benefits rather than having them all become public goods. So if we were to say that the expected enterprise challenges, as we see it, were technology, privacy, competition over access to user identity, making mobile payment and commerce easier for the user and for the small and medium-sized business merchant, figuring out how to get from virtual goods to the real world, and how to come up with innovative business models to monetize value generated by network effects. The funny thing that we're discovering by having some of these things is the unexpected enterprise challenges that big data and mobile and social create. It turns out that there's a huge resistance from the IT departments that are happy with the relational databases and the customer relationship management systems that they have. So there's a real sense of not invented here from structured database managers who are saying, I don't want to know what the social media or mobile people are doing. It doesn't fit into my database, and so I can't analyze it as personal or business intelligence. Secondly, where does this big data DNA come? Where are you going to find the talent and the leadership for the key kinds of new analytics that have to be created? A lot of people are saying it might come from China and from India. In fact, some of the most interesting new big data plays that we're seeing are coming from India. And many are saying that in Asia, there's more of the physics and the kinds of talents that are needed for big data that might actually end up being used in startups. Decision 2.0. What's fascinating, I had just come from a meeting with one of the big social gaming companies, Playdom, where the CFO was telling me, since they've been acquired by Disney, that it's been really interesting to see the difficulty of persuading people in the media industry that intuition and experience is not really as powerful as analytics. But that now they've been able to prove that data, because social gaming is very data intensive, is the third voice in the room. I think that's a fascinating way to put it. A third voice in the room. In the past, whoever had the loudest voice was heard, or the person who had the most experience said, I know that this is going to be the blockbuster winner. I know because I feel it, and I've got the intuition, and I've got the experience and the track record to show for it. Well, it turns out that the third voice in the room is the data. If you have the analytics, often you could come up with more frequent sort of one and two kinds of hits, rather than trying to go for the risky kind of home runs that sometimes don't play out. So we're discovering that analytics might be the way to go for many big decisions. Finding those insights and having clues as to where the insights might be in the haystack of information is a big one. And finally, the really, really big challenge is going to be making big data as easy as Google search, making it as visual and as simple to use so that it can be in the hands of the many people that need to use it. Every employee that needs it, every single enterprise user who has a mobile phone that is given to them by their corporate employer needs to have an app, and an app that makes sense of the big data that that company actually has. So Enterprise Mobile 3.0. So it's funny that, you know, if you were to think that Steve Jobs had said creativity is just connecting things, when you ask creative people how they did something, they feel guilty because they just saw it. They just saw something. It was obvious to them. They were able to connect experiences they had and synthesize new things. So you have this sense that, from Steve Jobs, is that creative people are the talented people in the world. They're the ones who see the connections. In some ways, what big data is saying is that every one of us can be a creative person. We can have the tools in big data to visualize some of those connections. Any one of us could make use of those connections and synthesis. So, if we were to remember Peter Drucker's view, I've told you my view of the future, but for each of you after hearing this, hopefully you'll come away with the thought, especially in big data, social media, and mobile, that the best way to predict the future is for you to create it. So go out there and do it. Thank you.